Good evening. We continue with our series on the incidental Zionists. Akiva, to this evening, we're going to be talking about Rabbi Akiva Yosef Schlesinger. Just to catch you up and to thank you again for joining us, a friendly reminder that what we've been doing throughout this series is we've been examining certain individuals to figure out, are they what we would call a Zionist in a classic sense? Or perhaps maybe not exactly what you would call in your conventional world the quintessential Zionist, and maybe more incidental than anything else, sort of developing this idea that not everything in life is really sort of black and white. We've talked about the Nativ, we've talked about Shlomo Yosef Seven, we talked about the Imre Emes last week, and now, in this week's session, we're going to conclude this year's aspect of the series by talking a little bit about an individual who is perhaps the most misunderstood. If we started with the Litvish Rosh Hashiva and we talked about a Chabad Chassid, and then we moved on to talk about a Chassidish Rebbe, we would be nowhere if we were talking about the Zionistic times and didn't include a Hungarian Ruf. And of course, to do so, we will introduce ourselves this evening to an individual who was so confusing that the Neturei Karta counts him among their founders and their leaders, and the Zionist movement counts him. So you really can't get more diverse than that. And of course, let's launch ourselves into the life and times of Rabbi Akiva Yosef Schlesinger. First of all, when did he live? So he lived between 1837 and 1922. And as a child, he was sort of brought up in this Hungarian ascetic manner. His father would wake him up at midnight. I'm sorry, his grandfather would wake him up at midnight to engage in Tikkun Chatzos, to study Tikkun Chatzos. In fact, when he wrote some of his Svarim, and we're going to see he was quite the prolific writer, he writes that if those we call sinners, and he of course was referring to the secular Zionist movement, he says, if those we call sinners work so hard and give so much for Tzion, then how much more so should we be expected of the people who say Tikkun Chatzos? Perhaps the Zionists must have some of this major zechus, since they are, after all, tinoko shenishbu, they're an infant captured by Gentiles, which means, of course, they haven't had the chance to go ahead and correct themselves and their errors. And so, but we what excuse do we have that we don't have that option or that opportunity to see where things have gone? And so Rav Schlesinger sort of gets brought up in this manner as a little boy is being woken up by his grandfather to say Tikkun Chatzos. Right? And his first teacher was his father, Rav Yechiel Schlesinger. His father was a very close Talmud of the Chasam Sofer, the famous Rav Moshe Schreiber, the big authority in Hungarian Jewry. And his father would become recognized by Rabbi Akiva Yosef as his sole master and mentor. He was the one who gave Rabbi Akiva Yosef Schlesinger, our protagonist this evening, the spirit of orthodoxy. And he also passed through this very conservative style that the Chasam Sofer was famous for. But still, even with all of that, he also made sure that his son had 4 years of elementary school, that he learned to read and write in German, which is fascinating when you think about a Hungarian who's speaking German, right? And he becomes a master at math, at which he particularly was known for. So here's this guy who's growing up in what we would consider much more of a background, where he should be sort of expected to be in the base medrash, speaking sort of a backwards language, and he's a whiz at math, and he's a whiz at German, and he reads and he writes, and he winds up growing up and then sent to the yeshiva of the Ksav Sofer, of Avram Shmuel Binyamin Sofer in Pressburg. And he winds up studying for a little while with Reb Chaim Sofer and Reb Moshe Shik, the Maram Shik, who was the number one student of the Chasam Sofer. And then he goes to Moravia, to the yeshiva of Shlomo Ketch. And there was that was an interesting choice, because in Moravia had a much more open environment to general culture, much more so, certainly, than the Hungarians. The Moravians were very, very, very open in that regard. And by the way, Rabbi Yosef Schlesinger writes that at this stage in his life, when he's in Moravia, he seriously considered becoming what you and I would call today much more Maddox, or Modern Orthodox, and that experience gave him a insight into the mindset of people who gave in to Modern Orthodoxy, something that we're going to see in the next little bit, he was very, very opposed to. So he comes back to Pressburg, and in 1857, remember, he's a young man of about 20 years old at this time, so he gets smicha from his Rebbe, from the Ksav Sofer, and he says, In his Ksav Smicha, in his Smicha book, it's written, Yiraso Kodemes Lechachmaso. His fear of God comes even before his wisdom. And the Ksav Sofer gives him a job. He's allowed to tutor the grandson of the Chasam Sofer, the son of the Ksav Sofer, Rav Simcha Bunim Sofer. And that becomes something very, it's a very big statement of trust. Then when you take this 20-year-old student and you turn him into the mentor for the future of all Hungarian leadership. But after that, something went a little bit awry. What went awry? When the Ksav Sofer heard that there was a shidduch proposed between his own niece and Rabbi Kiva Yosef Schlesinger, he said, I don't think so. And it seems from all aspects of the understanding of history, it has to do with the fact that Rabbi Kiva Yosef was not exactly from a wealthy family. Like I said to you before, his father was a rabbinic scholar, but he was not seen as somebody who would be able to take care of his niece, and so the Ksav Sofer said, better off to go someplace else. And so that created a certain degree of resentment from Rabbi Kiva Yosef Schlesinger. And it would be tempered to a certain degree by the affection that he had for the Ksav Sofer. But what can I tell you? You can't. When you get rejected, it certainly has an effect. Whatever happens, at 24 years old, 1860, he marries his wife Liba, who lived until 1917. She was the daughter of Rav Hillel Lichtenstein, who was then the Rav of the community of Margareten. Margareten was in eastern Hungary. And it's fascinating because when Rav Hillel Margareten becomes a widower, he marries Rabbi Kiva Yosef Schlesinger's younger sister, Fradel, which means that his father-in-law became his brother-in-law. Pretty avamistic, right? When your father-in-law is now your brother-in-law, it's all funny. But Rabbi Kiva Yosef was the one who urged it, and he encouraged this relationship. And until the Schlesinger family moves to Israel in 1870, the two couples live very close by, one against the other. And he follows his own personal family tradition. He will not consider the rabbinate for himself. Instead, he decides to become Rav Hillel Lichtenstein's right-hand man. In those days, the right-hand man to the rabbi in a town was known as the Dayan. He became one of the Dayunim in the court over there. And he became a Magid Shir in the yeshiva, first in Margareten, where Rav Hillel Lichtenstein served, and then subsequently in Cisco, in Hungary, and Kolomia in Galicia. And so at a time when Hungarian Orthodoxy goes into this period of major crisis because people are leaving in huge droves, they're trying to get out of the old-fashioned Hungarian Orthodoxy, Rav Hillel Lichtenstein and Rabbi Kiva Yosef Schlesinger, together with Rav Chaim Sofer and the descendants of the Chasam Sofer's family, they start collaborating in ideology, laying the foundations of what would later become known as ultra-Orthodoxy, right? And, of course, if you want to get your message out, you need somebody who is a publisher, a writer. Because in those days, there were no blogs, and there were no, the blog was you wrote books. Your blog was that you wrote a newspaper. And so back then, Rabbi Kiva Yosef Schlesinger and his father-in-law produced very, very explicitly ideological publications of Hungarian Orthodoxy, and they're the only ones who are publishing at that time to present and portray this very strong Hungarian ideology. In fact, Rabbi Kiva Yosef was the first one who printed. He starts writing a bunch of articles, both in Hebrew and also in German, between 1863 and 1869. And he becomes known as a zealot, just like his father-in-law. And in fact, people were accusing him of writing, his father-in-law of writing under his name. That's how extreme the writing was, but yet as solid as it was. Well, you get good at writing. Eventually, you put enough articles together and you publish books. Well, then you have a new problem. And what's the problem? Got to make sure the books sell. You know what a good way of getting books to sell? Make them controversial. You write a controversial book, it's going to become a book that sells. So in 1863, he publishes a book called Tzavos Moshe, the will of the Chasam Sofer, and he adds a commentary, V'Nilvalov Sefer Nar Ivri. He writes an appendix of his own. People not so excited by that book. But then, the next year, he puts a running commentary. Now he's not just putting a little bit of translation. He calls that Leifa Ivri. Pay attention to that work, the heart of the Hebrew. He becomes known as Ha-Ivri, the Hebrew, which, of course, gets certain people in post in the last 24, 25 years of current era to wonder if indeed he was an Ivri in the classical sense, namely a Zionist. But really, it's not. Ivri is just a combination of his name. His name is, Rabbi Akiva Yosef ben Yechiel. So he ben Rav Yechiel. And so he adds an extra yud there. And this is his first major manifesto. And then he follows again in 1866. And he writes this very strong rule. And he poses limits and strictures on innovation, right? And it all goes over very, very strongly. And then in 1865, he's also involved in the publication of a very important psak din, known as the psak din of Michalov. What's the psak din of Michalov? That psak din imposed very strong limits on innovations in shuls. You know, to make things, more modern and up to date. And he's fighting this the whole time. And he writes a passion-driven, racy Hebrew prose. And he's always condemning assimilation. He's against religious reforms. And he's very, very vulgar and wordy. And he attacks any manifestation of any sense of acculturation and in this work. And so Leif HaIvri becomes his big, huge foray. People come running after the book in order to do their best to be able to get their hands on the copies because it's got great stuff in there. And people are like dying to read the stuff. In fact, the Maskil Eliezer Tzvi Zwiffel is amazed at how in 1873, this is one of the hottest selling books in Orthodox Europe. And by the way, among other things, he's the guy who probably gets credit for the most of the association and making famous the comment of his Rebbe's father, the Chasam Sofer, Chadash Aser Min HaTorah. Literally, that refers to the understanding that the new crop brought during the Sfira period is forbidden to people on a Doraisa level. But misinterpreted or taken on a more homiletic level, it also means new innovation, chadash, aser min haTorah. So he keeps writing and he's arguing passionately that how important it is to safeguard the basic marks of tradition. And so he comes up with a new concept that he starts passing around called shalem. And what is that? He says, well, let's take a look. When the Jewish people were in Gullus the first time, Mitzrayim, there were certain ideologies that kept them the same. There was shame. They didn't change their names. There was the Lashon that they used. They continued to use the same language. And also, they dressed like Jews. They wore Malbush. Shalem, Shin is shame. Lamed is Lashon. And Mem is for Malbush, the way that they dressed. And so he says, to be a good Ivri, you need to have integrity. You need to dress, talk, and have names that are Jewish. And so, basically, he says, if somebody doesn't keep all three in the classic traditional sense, by definition, that person is no longer Orthodox. That person is Reform. Well, I have a surprise, because there were a lot of people who were not Reform, who were not so strict in dressing in the old form of 100 years earlier. That included the modern people. And so now Schlesinger starts a war in Europe, not only with the people who are not Shomrei Shabbos or the people who are assimilating. Schlesinger finds himself now all of a sudden fighting the modern Orthodox. And this becomes a very, very big deal for him. So this idea of Shalem becomes his mantra, and he keeps repeating it throughout all his writings. And he brings it up as this idea of Jewish nationalism, which he writes in a pamphlet to women called El HaDerim Afruf Al Judish Kinder, or translated in 1863 to the flocks, a call to all true Jews. In other words, he writes in German, right? And it doesn't write in classic Hebrew. And so he's trying to get even people who are not 100% up to date. He's not kicking them out of the camp. He's trying to get a nationalist idea going forward, how important it is for them to develop a preservation of name, dress, and language. These are nationalist characteristics, he writes. And he says, this is a supreme Jewish value. And so he looks out and reaches out to the Hungarian culture, and he says, take a look. Even in Hungary, somebody who encourages acculturation is a traitor both to the nation and the religion. And so if you become Hungarian, a Hungarian Jew, instead of a Jew living in Hungary, you're no longer Jewish. And he says, this was a Jewish nationalism that should later have a territorial identity. And so at this point, he doesn't push a territory. He's only trying to create a mindset. Later in 1868, 1869, he publishes El HaDarim Sheni, where he condemns the Shomrei Hadass Society for giving in to the authorities and paying lip service to the Magyar language. He writes another pamphlet, called Chever Machziri HaTorah LeYoshna, where he outlines the needs for the Orthodox people to organize. And so he realizes that going on in Israel right now, in 1863, the main environment is coming out of something called the Alliance Israelite Universelle. And that was really a secular environment to sort of encourage Zionistic growth. So he proposes in 1863 an Alliance der Hebräer, right? In effect, an international Orthodox union. And the people in the East, who are untouched by the modernity, they'll be involved in spiritual support to go ahead and sort of help out those who are in the West of Europe who are being threatened. Their orthodoxy is being threatened. And so maybe the Easterners will help the Westerners and all the pieces will come together. Well, ultimately, at the same time, the East could be a safe asylum to escape the cultural demands of a modern nation state. And he says, you know, there's a threatening urban environment culturally and sexually, and that it's not a good thing for a good, solid Jewish boy or girl. And so therefore, you could leave those areas to come to a pristine rural hinterland where you could have Torah and you can work. And he encourages people to get jobs in crafts and agriculture, etc. And they'll be able to have good, solid life. So he's not saying everyone has to sit and learn all day. That's not really what he's advocating. He's advocating a national Jewish identity worldwide where Torah is at the center. And during the years that lead up to this big Psakdin in Michalovitz, right, he plays a role as an emissary of his father-in-law, of Rav Hillel Lichtenstein. And he crisscrosses the country in Hungary, doing all sorts of different errands. And he had a hand in the formulation of the Psakdin. Well, between 1866 and 1867, he writes something called a monthly magazine called Amud Hajira, which contains a supplement called Amud HaTorah. And in addition to his own articles that he's writing, there are reports from all bunches of places, including Israel. And he manages to get several hundred subscribers to come by the journal. And like I said to you before, Reuven, he who has the power of the pen and the power of the publishing also has the power to influence society. And so as he moves through the eastern part of Hungary, and all of a sudden he finds out people aren't only speaking Hebrew. Jews in the eastern part of Hungary, they speak a different language, Yiddish. And so he says, whoops, I'm sorry, I've been writing this journal in a little bit of Jewish German. And he says, I'm going to switch over. And now his journal starts getting published in Yiddish. This all takes him through the 1860s. But in 1870, he says, enough already. Time for me to make a change. And here's where the fun starts. In 1870, he and his family come to Yerushalayim. Comes to Yerushalayim. He's a journalist. He's the writer of the commentary, Leifa Ivri. He's recognized as a celebrity. Well, not exactly. He's a celebrity in name, but financially, the guy's penniless. And so he has to go find himself a job. And so he finds himself in charge of the mikveh in the Tiferes Yisrael shul in the old city of Yerushalayim. Happy Yom Yerushalayim to everybody. And this shul is second in size only to the churva of Rabbi Yehuda HaChassid, which, of course, has been rebuilt. And by the way, just so you know, this Tiferes Yisrael shul is also the place where, in 1948, the Jewish community surrendered to the Jordanians until they came back in 1967 today. So he rents an apartment near the Kotel, and he says, I can't bear being in Yerushalayim and not davening as close to the Makom HaMikdash as possible. And so he starts a minyan in his apartment, which he called his Beis Medrash, just to be as close to the Kotel as possible. If you recall your visits to Israel and Yerushalayim, the Churva Shul is not that close to the Kotel. So there's a lot more space. He gets the chance to get closer. And within 2 years, he starts a big fight with the reigning secular Zionist growth effort there. Again, the Alliance Israelite Universal, and the fact that they were controlling the schools. He also realizes that he's got to fight the modern Orthodox, who are being led by Rav Azriel Hildesheimer. And he says, I got to, you know, and they're all trying to open a school for all the Yisomim, for all the orphans. Well, in 1872, he writes a Kol Nechi Mitzion, a volume about the hurt, the cries of Tzion, where he gets hundreds into the Yishuv to endorse the Psak Din and Michalovitz about against innovations in the shuls, etc., and also against secular education. However, the conditions leave him very unsatisfied. And he is fighting not only the modern Orthodox and not only the secular. He discovers that within the Orthodox community, the money is controlled by a central authority. Most people at that point in time in Israel who were more Haredi, what we would call Haredi, Hasidic, Eastern European, they were living primarily off something called the Chalukah system. Whether you were learning in Kollel or you were working a farm, you were getting charity, and depending on the rules of the people who controlled it, that's how the division of the money would come. Well, he doesn't see, he sees that the Chalukah system, he decides, is being run by corrupt people, and the people were trying to discourage immigration by turning around and saying that you can't get a full chalukah for the first 2 years. And so he sees this as both criminally unjust and also, to be quite honest, economically disastrous. If we don't have the money, where are people going to go? They're going to go to the secular in order to be able to get to survive. And so it also goes against his messianistic expectations. And so he has already adopted a philosophy that this is supposed to be Reshit Smichas Gulasenu, that this is the beginning of the Geula, and that part of his responsibility and the responsibility of Jews living here at this time is to go ahead and create agricultural settlements. And this is not a big chiddush. This is something that his Rebbe, the Chasam Sofer, had already encouraged in Pressburg in 1821. He just carried it to Israel to tell people, okay, it's time for us to go there. He also, at this time, he starts to do some other strange things. He starts to wear tchelas of the Razina Rebbe. Well, the local rabbinate doesn't really appreciate that. And so he gets accosted for being an outsider, and they literally destroy and burn his tchelis and his talis. In 1871, also, Rosh Hashanah falls out on Shabbos, as it will this coming year. And he decides that he wants to blow shofar. After all, he's in Yerushalayim, that the whole takana was not for Yerushalayim. And so he goes to Rav Meir Orbach, the Imre Bina, and he says, I'd like to blow shofar in Yerushalayim on Shabbos. He gets rebuffed. He'll try this again in 1881, and he issues a pamphlet as to why it should be mutter, and again, it wasn't allowed. But in 1904 and 1905, Rosh Hashanah will fall out for 2 years in a row on a Shabbos. And he begs the Rabbanim to reconsider. And he argues very strongly that Yerushalayim has the status of the Beis HaMikdash, where in the time of the Gemara they did blow Rosh Hashanah, when Rosh Hashanah fell out on Shabbos. He argues that the Rif would have agreed. He argues on an emotional front in 1904 that the pogroms of Russia call upon the Jews for drastic actions. And just like in the days of Mordechai and Esther, the Jews fasted on Pesach, which was also not okay. Maybe this year, the sound of the shofar will serve as a zechus for the Jews of Russia, right? If they're blowing in Yerushalayim. And he appeals to the local rabbinate. Who are the local rabbis? Rav Shmuel Salant. And the Aderet, which of course means the Tites family. There's always something that flows through Elizabeth. And so he begs the two of them to please allow the blowing of shofar on Shabbos, which is something that is absolutely forbidden. Ultimately, he writes in his tshuvas that the Aderet and Rav Shmuel Salant actually agreed with him. But at the last minute, the crowd fought against him. And they held back. They changed their minds and didn't let him go ahead and proceed. Rumor has it that he chose to blow shofar in his own house on Rosh Hashanah, which today, by our standards, would be the equivalent of basically driving, you know, turning on your oven on Shabbos in your own house, right? But you know what is real big. His real big trouble really starts to get into place. He's become known now as like a little bit of a separatist, a little bit of a stranger. He's fighting against the main rabbinic leadership and certainly the secular leadership. He writes a volume in 1873, Machzikei Atara LiYoshna, right? And he brings out this new idea that there should be an Orthodox utopia. There should be in this Orthodox utopia Hebrew language, a Jewish attire, there should be a flag, there should be militia, there should be an elected assembly. That's the best way to make sure that Jewish culture establishes itself in Israel. Sounds somewhere between Walden, Thoreau's Walden, what he's suggesting, and something that you and I might call Zionism, right? Somewhere in between over there, right? Flags and militias, etc. But nowhere was there a call for a Jewish state. That came a year later. He writes to Moses Montefiore, right? And as he writes to Montefiore, he makes it clear that what he wants to do is establish a state, right? And he says, though, as he wants to establish it, he doesn't want to establish it against the Ottoman Turks, who were in charge of the land at the time. He wants it to be under the Ottoman Turks. So, and he makes the following argument, and I'd like to read it to you, translated. One can't deny what the eyes see. Praise Hashem, the words of Shmuel, which the Rambam put into law, came to fruition only here in Israel. Namely, there's Ein Bein Olam Hazav Yemos HaMashiach El Shibud Malchios Bovad, that there's no difference between this world and the days of Mashiach other than the subjugation to the kingdoms. So he says, Baruch Hashem, the glorious government here, and he's referring to the Ottoman Turks, he says, they don't oppress the Jews at all. They don't prevent them from serving Hashem. And you can do what you want to go ahead and keep the Torah and guard the path of Hashem in the best possible way. He says, this must be the beginning of the Geula with the help of Hashem. I guess he would say, Reishis Smichas Geulasenu. It's the beginning of the expression of the first flowering of Israel. He then also says, people also need not to just follow a Gadol, one individual. What you need in order to govern this group of people is a Sanhedrin, right? and they follow the group decisions of the majority. So don't leave everything in a corruptible one-person hand. And he also starts arguing in the same work that people should marry at 18 years old, and they should get to learn in kolo for 3 years thereafter. But after 3 years, people have to sit down and realize that not everyone is cut out to be sitting and learning every day. Now, P.S., that's an interesting statement from a guy who is a rabbinic figure living in Israel, arguing a Haredi lifestyle. But it's not wild when you consider who he is and that he's Hungarian, and that the Chasam Sofer understood that as well. So he says people who should be sitting and learning all day, every day, will support them. But we should also support other people who go to do a different type of learning, namely going to learn a trade. Let them learn how to farm. Let them learn how to tend crops. He says, you know, the kolo system, that's which of course he's using a broad branch definition of kolo at this point. You know, it means the chalukah system. He says their accounting books need to be open to everybody. They need to be transparent. He says we should encourage Aliyah. After all, I can't understand. Say, olden days, it used to take people months and months, years and years to get to Israel. Today, it's 10 days on a ship. He says, and this is also going to get him into excitement, everyone needs to go on patrol to save the Yishuv. That means if you live in the community, whether you have a long beard or whether you are a police officer, everyone does Shmirah 1 month every year, even on Shabbos. That means you do have guard duty, right? This doesn't really sound very Haredi now, does it, Reuven, right? Now, but here he is, and this is his argument in the book. He also argues that everyone should have a flag. There should be a big flag for the Kol HaIvrim. He describes the colors of the flag. No, it's not blue and white. It's white, purple, it's white, green, purple, and turquoise. And then he says we should go back to the Shevet system so that everyone also has their own personal flags as well. And then he makes another statement. He says, I know how amazing it is to live here in Yerushalayim. Just the other day, I had this incredible excitement as I took my 10 camels up to Yerushalayim with Maaser Rishon, Maaser Sheni, and Maaser Ani. What are you writing? You can't write about Maaser today, since the time of the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash. We don't separate and give Trumos and Maaseros. We have to do what we can to separate the Trumos and Maaseros. And he's talking about bringing it up. What happened to him? And so the Haredi community, which didn't like him to begin with because he was an interloper, they start rubbing their hands together. And we see that trouble is already afoot. In 1875, trouble bursts wide open. He writes a work called Beis Yosef HaChadash, and he starts going very strongly in that wonderful strong language that got him to become a best-selling author, right? Where he argues about acculturation and reform, but with that really strong language. And then he says something fascinating as he's calling for Aliyah. He turns around and he says, well, you have to understand something. Why don't people make Aliyah? He looks around Israel and he sees a whole bunch of men and not enough women. And he's trying to figure out why is that. And he realizes many of these men are married men from Russia who had gone to live inside Israel. For what reason? They ran away to get out of the conscription into the Russian army. You wound up conscripted into the Russian army. You could be there for 30 years. And so the men ran away. So when they flee to Israel, their wives are like, we're not coming with you. What are you out of your mind? We're very comfortable here living in the shtetl, singing tradition, right? With the Tevi the milkman. So the men are standing there in Israel. They don't have any wives. They want to be able to live a life. So he makes the following proposition. Maybe we should suspend the Cherem de Rabbeinu Gershom. The Cherem de Rabbeinu Gershom forbade men from having more than one wife. And he says, maybe we should suspend it just so that, you know, people can get married to a second wife and maybe have babies and go ahead and have a Jewish life. The old timers, who anyway didn't like him because he was against them, they look at this and they go, aha, this guy's a reformer. He pretends he's not, and he curses at us, and he goes against everything. But look, he calls his sefer Beis Yosef HaChadosh like he thinks he's Rav Yosef Cairo. And now he's getting rid of Chirim de Rabbeinu Gershom. This guy's book has to be burned. And so they excommunicate him, and they throw his books into the fire. They publish a work called Nitzotz HaBayis, the Sparks of the House, and they argue that he thinks he's so great, and then they kick him out of the community. His Rebbe, the Maram Shik, who is this tremendous authority in Hungary, in the old home, turns around and says, I think you guys misunderstand him, he's not a reformer, but it doesn't help. In Yerushalayim, the man's name is Mud. In fact, they tried to kick him out of Yerushalayim and out of Israel, but he stayed. So now he's out of the limelight, and he decides he's going to start buying land. Maybe he'll get involved in some agricultural settlement. So in 1876, he tries to purchase land in Migdal Eder. Migdal Eder, by the way, came up in the Mishnah Yomis today, so everything is all connected. And he says, why is he buying in Migdal Eder? Because they say that's where Mashiach is supposed to come from. And so he says, this is a Schalta de Geula. It'll be in Jewish hands. Not that he's declaring himself to be a Messiah. We talked about those people last year. He's not on the list. Then he decides, you know what, I'm going to get involved in real estate in other places. And so he goes a little bit further north, and he gets involved in a little settlement there called Petach Tikva. I think you've heard of it. Ema Moshe Avot. It's the mother of all the settlements. And he gets involved in purchasing land in the second phase. Now, he needs money to be able to find it, to find this land. And so he proposes that on the day that they start casting lots as to who gets which lot, that they should declare a public fast. And then they should go into the Yarkon to purify themselves. And then they should daven Shacharis as though it was Hoshana Rabbah. In other words, this was a big deal. He wanted to imbue this buying of land in Petach Tikva with a very important spiritual significance. And then they should say Tehillim, and then they should fast, and they should daven until nighttime, and then they should have a big yantif. And he turns around, and he convinces his father-in-law to invest with him into Petach Tikva. And in 1878, he gets his father-in-law to pay for it. And right before he signs the papers, his father-in-law says, okay. But he turns the land over to the Hungarian Kollel, which is basically the ultimate slap in the face to Rabbi Kibbe Yosef Schlesinger. These are the guys who just kicked him out of the yeshiv. These are the guys who are against him. These are the guys he feels are a bunch of traitors. Well, he takes them to a Beis Din. He wins some of the battles, but the Hungarian Kollel Chalukka system know one thing about him. He'll never go to secular court. So they start yanking him around by a chain to keep him locked up in Beis Din systems his whole life. In the years to come, he winds up publishing some interesting and provocative texts, and he starts to see that the Zionist movement is starting to fulfill prophecies. He starts to see dozens of writings that get printed in his lifetime. And basically, he winds up leaving life not really being on the major stage. He writes Shilos Tshuvas. He's a player, right? Not a very major player, but a player during that time. But he never really gets the renown that he probably deserved in society at that particular point in history. He dies, as I said before, in 1922. In the late 90s or early 2000, there was a very important conference that was held in the Ben Tzvi Institute, which is one of the big Zionist institutes in Israel, as to whether Akiva Yosef Schlesinger is a Zionist or not. So let me begin with my arguments in favor of why I think you can argue the man was a Zionist. First of all, he's against the Yishuv HaYeshan. He fights them. The old Yishuv, which was opposed to anything Zionistic, he fights them. He is pro-people coming to Israel making Aliyah. He's pro-people working. He's pro-people protecting the land. He's pro-nationalism. He was pro-nationalism even before he made Aliyah. He's pro-teaching in Ivrit. It was only after the Yiddishists came along that he even abandoned the idea in Europe. But certainly in Israel, he was pro-teaching boys and girls that they should speak Ivrit. He's pro-establishing a local governing body. In fact, if you go around three different neighborhoods in Israel, you'll find streets named after him. In Yerushalayim, you'll find Rehov Lev HaIvri. In Tel Aviv and Petach Tikva, you'll find Rehov Rabbi Akiva Schlesinger. In each of the neighborhoods, you don't usually name cities after the Neturei Karta. There is no street anywhere in Israel called Rehov Neturei Karta. Right? So if you're going to argue that the guy is an anti-Zionist, these things certainly suggest otherwise. In fact, there's a whole settlement called B'nai Ayish. Ayish is Akiva Yosef Schlesinger, right? And it's named after him. Thus, it seems like sort of like maybe in his philosophy somewhere in that thinking, you're dealing with a guy who might fit more of the Zionist in camp than his look would have. On the other hand, the Neturei Karta write very openly in their open manifestos that the founder of their movement in the writings of Rabbi Akiva Yosef Schlesinger. After all, look, he was opposed to modernity. He never discussed nationalism as a state. He was opposed to secular people. He was even more opposed to modern Orthodox. He said he was of the opinion that the people of Israel, he was very supportive. The state, it sounds like he saw that as different. And he doesn't see this concern of a national consciousness, even though he was pro the concept of Shivat Zion. He is also a very funky person when it comes to halacha and a halachic Zionist. He has certain views that at times seem to be a little bit more progressive than society. At other times, he seems to take steps backwards. But he becomes a person, again, about whom we can have a debate. The beauty of the land of Israel and subsequently the state of Israel, and the beauty that I think that we've uncovered as we've developed the four personalities of this year's ER series, The Incidental Zionist, should hopefully have been for each and every one of us the understanding that what makes a person a Ben Eretz Yisrael and a forecaster of Medinat Yisrael is not to be confined to one box. It is impossible for a Jew to exist without any relationship with Eretz Yisrael. It is probably very unlikely that a person can exist as a Jew without any connection to some aspect of, some element of, a yearning, a desire, a hope, an involvement of Medinat Yisrael in some way, shape, form, or precursor. And so we've now discovered that throughout Europe, all the major different elements, whether it was Chabad, whether it was the Litvish Rosh Yeshiva, whether it was the Hasidish Rebbe, whether it was the Hungarian Ruf, we find that all of them had certain hopes for a true sense of settlement of Eretz Yisrael. And so here we end our series on Yom Yerushalayim, on a period in time where all of them, all of us, no matter what we wear on our heads, and no matter how we associate, we can all hope for Moadim L'Simcha, for opportunities for Moadim that will be for joy, but with an awareness, like all four of the characters we've talked about, that it should be L'Gula Shleima, and that that's something that's still yet to be attained, not just simply with a state, but with a certain understanding that as our state goes through challenge, that there's the HaKadosh Baruch Hu overseeing that challenge, and that it's to him that ultimately the Geula Shleima will come. Thank you all very much for joining us for the series, and Bezrat Hashem, we will learn much more together for many good years to come. Moadim L'Simcha, the Geula Shleima.